This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices, episode 413, was produced on February 1st, 2024. I'm Eric Townsend. 42 Macro founder Darius Dale returns as this week's feature interview guest. Darius says the stock market's bull run is set to continue. We'll discuss markets, inflation, bond yields, and much more.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, January 31st, 2024. The S&P 500 March futures were down 57 basis points, trading at 4870. On the surface, it doesn't look like a big change week over week, but it is important to note there was an FOMC drop of 80 points yesterday. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the post-game segment. The US dollar index up 25 basis points, trading at 103.51. The March WTI crude oil contract up 101 basis points to 75.85. It was noteworthy that the breakout last week approached $79 before retracing the gains. We'll look at that chart in the postgame, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. The March RBOB gasoline down 45 basis points, trading at 223. The April gold contract up 157 basis points, trading to 2067. Copper up 26 basis points to 390. And uranium down 255 basis points, trading at 101.25. Uranium continuing to consolidate after its very bullish rise over the last 4 months. The U.S. 10-year Treasury yield down 27 basis points, trading at 391, a relentless decline for the entire week. The key news to watch this week is Friday's jobs numbers, and next week we have the ISM Services PMI. This week's feature interview guest is 42 Macro founder Darius Dale. Eric, why did we invite Darius back on as guest this week?
Well, Patrick, Darius has made several excellent January calls. We've had him on, almost made a Macro Voices tradition of getting him as one of our first guests in January. I guess we slipped a little bit this month. We're a day off on February 1st. We got him back. So we're a little bit late this year, but he's made some excellent calls, including calling the bear market perfectly in, what was that, January of 22. So it's time to get him back and keep the string of good calls going.
Well, Eric's interview with Darius Dale is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is 42 Macro founder Darius Dale. Darius, as always, has prepared an extensive slide deck to accompany today's interview. Registered users will find the link to the slide deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Click the red button above Darius's photo that says looking for the downloads. Darius, it's great to get you back on the show. We've kind of made a tradition of doing January interviews for the last few years. You've had some really good calls at the beginning of the year. I guess we slipped it into the beginning of February this year, but give us the big picture. What should we expect this year? Last we had you on, you were still expecting a recession and maybe a lower low in the bear market. Needless to say, we're looking at new all-time highs. So how's the new market data line up with your expectations?
Yeah, Eric, thanks again for having me back on the show, man. It's always a pleasure. So I just make one quick caveat to your intro there. The last I was on the show, we were calling for a blow off top in the equity market as a function of a potential a recession on the calendar. That has since
been. Well, that's right. And you predicted that we would get new all-time highs first before the bear market would resume. I forgot that. So that is playing out if that's what you still think is happening.
Yeah. So, yeah, we've been generally bullish since since January of last 2023. Continue to be pretty bullish. There's a lot of economic information and critical macro, micro, and policy updates this week that could potentially change that. But barring any material change to that, it's very, you know, I think it's potentially off to the races. So I'll give you a quick background on where we are from a, you know, quantitative standpoint in terms of how we think about the world. We use a system of quantitative tools here at 42 Macro to keep our clients on the right side of market risk. If we throw up slide 7 in this deck where we just show we are still currently in a Goldilocks market regime. I mean, Goldilocks appears to have peaked, but certainly doesn't necessarily mean that it has to end anytime soon. With respect to the anytime soon portion of that, if you go to slide 10 in the deck where we show today's update of our macro weather model, which we update and refresh along with all of our quantitative risk management signals for our clients 6 times a week here at 42 Macro, the current constellation of signals there in the middle of the page per asset class sort of gives us a, I would say, middling probability of, you know, continuing in this risk on type condition over the next 3 months. And then when you layer that on with our fundamental research, which is what the broad, you know, what most of the content in this presentation addresses, on slide 15, we summarize all that content. When you layer it on with our fundamental research, we believe this could be another really good year for investors. The probability of recession has diminished substantially, and the probability of a soft landing has risen substantially. I don't think I'm cracking any eggs when I say that, but I do think it's important for investors to understand why those probabilities have shifted, because ultimately that will allow investors to have some confidence and faith on the sustainability of a bull run, continuation of the bull run that we called for.
Now, it sounds like you're mostly looking at sustained bull run, that scenario we talked about last time of that bull run ending and rolling over to a new bear market. Is that still on the table?
You know, I would say the probability of it rolling over into a new bear market has also diminished substantially. So, you know, you can make the case that, you know, we probably were right for the wrong reasons in calling for the blow off top the last time we were on the program last summer. But ultimately, you know, we are on a Bayesian research process and a Bayesian risk management process. And the evolution of those signals in terms of both those independent processes has pushed us into, you know, the soft landing camp for now. I'll be very clear to investors. I think it's very important that investors avoid pigeonholing themselves into either the soft, no, or hard landing camps. It's our job as investors to make and save money in financial markets, period. So at the end of the day, we're riding with the hot hand, and the hot hand is soft landing. And we can unpack why the hot hand may continue to be the soft landing with respect to the immediate term, intermediate term.
Darius, it sounds like there has been a change then in the sense that you said recession risk is coming down. You're expecting that this bull run could last. So it's a much more optimistic outlook than we had last time. What's changed in order to improve the outlook?
Yeah, absolutely. So the number one thing that's changed at the margins is this big bump we've seen in productivity growth. If you go up to slide 38, where we show in the top panel productivity growth, the Fed funds rate in the second panel, and the growth rate of government consumption and investment in the third panel, we see that productivity growth has popped up to an above trend rate. And the reason that's important is because it's one of those elements that you need to actually experience a soft landing in the economy. That's what the green dotted lines in that chart indicate. The red dotted lines indicate a hard landing. And so, as you can see, we've only had two of the last 9 tightening cycles since the Fed began using the Fed funds rate as the main policy tool have ended in soft landings. So what has to happen to actually have a soft landing? Well, you need to have above trend productivity growth coupled by above trend fiscal stimulus and a quick Fed pivot to rate cuts. And that's sort of what we're currently getting, that policy mix that we are currently getting now. With respect to the Fed funds rate, or at least with price in the money markets and the current above trend fiscal spending coinciding with this sort of above trend level of productivity growth is creating a higher probability of a soft landing here in the U.S. economy. If you look at slide 39, where we show our corporate profitability model relative to the growth rate of NIPA corporate profits, our corporate profitability model, for those who are unfamiliar, it's the growth rate of nominal gross domestic income minus the spread between unit labor costs and productivity growth. And as you can see, we are moving in the right direction with respect to that green shaded area curve, moving up in terms of you know, corporate profitability. So that's taking pressure off of corporate margins in terms of you know, reducing the need for them to fire workers or pass on price increases through the lens of trying to maintain margins. If you look at slide 40, where we show our corporate profitability model overlaid with NIPA corporate profit growth and S&P earnings on a max drawdown basis, we see that, you know, this recovery in our corporate profitability model, which has historically led big drawdowns in S&P earnings, this recovery that we're observing in our corporate profitability model suggests that we're not going to see a big drawdown in S&P earnings. Slide 41 suggests we're not going to see a big enough drawdown in Nipper corporate profits to expect the kind of mass hiring that you would typically need to see as an investor, typically need to see for the NBER to get excited about a recession. And so the kind of the key takeaway on all this is really on slide 42, where we show the spread in the blue line, the spread between unit labor, or sorry, the spread between wage growth and productivity growth. The red line shows headline CPI, and the black line shows core PCE. And as you can see, we're kind of back to a more middling level in terms of the blue line, which has historically been a leading indicator of, you know, these big sharp fluctuations in inflation. And it makes a lot of sense, right? If you're paying your workers, the growth rate of what you're paying them far exceeds their productivity, you typically need to push through price increases through the economy to protect margins. Well, the need for them to do that is obviously much lower now than where it was the last time we spoke. And so these, you know, these critical economic developments have all occurred under the guise of, you know, more immaculate disinflation with respect to the inflation data. If you just quickly go to slide 35, where we show core PPI overlaid with core CPI and core PCE, core PPI is back to a more normal level, which suggests that the more lagging components of core CPI and core PCE are likely to trend lower. Slide 36 shows the immaculate disinflation that we continue to observe in the core PCE time series, in so much that the three-month annualized rate is one below the target and lower than the six-month annualized, which itself is lower than the year-over-year. So we know all those numbers are headed lower over the medium term. That's the same dynamic we're observing on slide 37 with super core CPI, which is core services ex housing. So just to kind of summarize all that, the probability of a soft landing has gone up. It's gone up in the context of continuing to observe immaculate disinflation in the time series. And so this is why the bond market, the money markets, have really been correct in pricing in an about-face pivot by the Fed, which are obviously, going back to that chart 38 we talked about, would support a soft landing expectation in the economy. So in our opinion, I think you know, it's a lot of good news. Now, we're going to get a lot of these data points this week. And so check back with us for that update in terms of our subscribers. But you know, for now, things are pretty good.
Okay, so it's basically a good news picture for investors. I know that your system is designed to break the economy down according to growth and inflation and basically make asset allocation recommendations depending on which season we're in cyclically. What are your models telling you? Where should investors be allocating assets in this cycle?
Yeah, so there's two elements of our process in terms of how we use our signals and research to support investors. One, we run a systematic portfolio construction process. That's called our KISS portfolio construction process, where we show that on slide 11. That's the background on it. Slide 12 just shows the back test, the out-of-sample back test that we're running live. And by the way, I use this KISS system to manage my entire liquid net worth. So it's obviously doing quite well for our clients since its introduction. So the key takeaways on slide 12 there are, you know, KISS, you can expect an average annual return of about 12% in this process versus a average annual return of about 8% for 60/40. On a max drawdown basis, KISS is about minus 11% versus minus 22% for 60/40 and minus 26% for a trend following process similar to KISS that does not feature the risk management overlays that we introduced on slide 11. And so, you know, right now, if you go to slide 13, where we show our current KISS portfolio construction, we're at 10% cash, 50% equities, 30% fixed income, and 10% Bitcoin, 83% of our max exposure in equities. We're at 100% of our max exposure in fixed income. We're 100% of our max exposure in Bitcoin, and only 10% of our max exposure in terms of cash. We do have some put premium on in terms of all three of those positions. And again, it's only ever three positions. So we do have some put premium on, expecting that we could potentially see some adverse outcomes and some of the important critical economic updates we're going to get this week, not the least of which is the QRA, which we can talk about, the Jones report we're going to get tomorrow. On Wednesday, we're going to get the employment cost index, and Thursday, unit labor cost productivity. So, and then obviously a jobs report on Friday. And oh, by the way, we have five of the seven Magnificent Seven reporting this week as well. So there's a lot of information for investors to digest. And this is why we thought, from a discretionary standpoint, adding some put premium for an investor portfolio, for a long-only portfolio, made sense. But broadly speaking, we are generally bullish. And until one of our signals change, either the quantitative elements of our risk management process or the fundamental elements of our research process change in a material manner, I do believe that we're going to be rewarded for maintaining this bullish posture, which again, we've had since January of last year. In terms of how other investors use our research, so that, you know, we built our KISS portfolio construction process really to satisfy the investment needs and objectives of retail investors and RIA
type investors, investment advisor type investors. But we also have obviously clients all over Global Wall Street across, you know, various, you know, different capacities. And we use our discretionary investment idea summary on slide 14 as a risk management overlay for those investors. So you can sort of see exactly what our systems and our models and fundamental research process is sort of recommending across the various sectors and asset classes. And the key takeaway is that it's broadly bullish. You know, there's some obviously negative signals in there if you look at the Japanese yen or commodities no position. But broadly speaking, this has been a good time to take risks. We've been right about that for quite a while. And it continues to be a good time to take risks, again, albeit with the caveat that we may get some data that changes that this week.
Let's talk about where we are in the inflation cycle. A lot of the fear was that the Fed might be having to try to cut rates, but still be fighting inflation up toward the election. Do we have a risk that inflation is going to rear its ugly head before the election? And is that going to put the Fed in a difficult position?
So if you think about this from a distributional standpoint, if there are three outcomes that the economy can experience based on the starting point, there's a soft landing, there's a no landing. And by the way, we'll define it just so we, to help investors so that we're all kind of speaking the same language here. Soft landing, in our opinion, just means there's a period of trend or below trend growth that allows inflation to decelerate without causing a significant drawdown in total employment or income, consumption, investment, all that good stuff. A hard landing would obviously be a recession. You know, everyone knows what that looks like, it smells like. Then a no landing would just be growth stays at or above trend in a way that prevents inflation and the labor market from continuing to cool. Just as an aside, the reason we're calling it immaculate disinflation is because it's typically not observed prior to a recession. I think we showed the slide last time we were on Eric's slide 60 in that deck where we show inflation being the most lagging indicator of the business cycle. When you look at the relationship to that cycle and all the different indicators that comprise the inflation cycle, they typically break down at about 6 to 8 months after a recession starts, which is the most lagging breakdown relative to the other elements of the economy, whether you think about housing, orders, production, profit, employment, et cetera. You know, even if you look at slide 61, the particular column that shows the evolution of core PCE prior to recession is typically flat to up on a median basis. So all of the disinflation that we've observed year to date, or really not year to date, over the last kind of several quarters, all that disinflation has been very immaculate. And so when you think about the risk to the market regime, obviously being Goldilocks, pricing in that rising and elevated probability of a soft landing, the threat to Goldilocks will either come from what we call inflation, which is a risk-off regime with an inflationary bias, or deflation, which is a risk-off regime with a disinflationary bias. In our opinion, we think inflation is more likely to be the next regime up in terms of Goldilocks. Whenever Goldilocks does end, we have a view that it's probably not going to end, you know, over the least the next quarter or two. If it does end in the next quarter or two, it's probably going to be as a function of the data we receive this particular week. But again, we'll reserve judgment on that. In terms of, if I could show one more slide, if you look at slide 64, where we show median CPI, trim mean CPI, the median PC deflator, trim mean PC deflator, the core PC deflator, and the super core PC deflator, you know, you're getting, you know, sort of what I would call very positive news from the perspective of the PC deflator elements of these underlying inflation elements. You know, median PC deflator is at 2.8%. That's slightly above trend, 3-month annualized. We're at 2.3% trim mean PCE. That's slightly above trend. We're right at trend in terms of core PCE at 1.5%, lowest number we've seen since mid to late 2020. We're right at trend in terms of super core PCE in terms of the 3-month annualized level, 3-month annualized rate there, lowest number we've seen since, you know, kind of late 2020 as well. But what worries me is that we are now moving in the wrong direction in terms of the trend, the underlying trend of things like median CPI and trim mean CPI. And those numbers are well above their respective trends at 4.6% and 3.4% 3-month annualized, respectively. You know, so that's something that is quite concerning. We did a deep dive study on investing during a fourth turning regime last fall and continue to update the data in that study on a live basis. And one of the key takeaways in that particular study on slide 70 and 71, we show that inflation tends to be relatively strong and spike during fourth turnings. That's exactly what we observed in this particular fourth turning as well. We expect that dynamic to persist. And then you look at our secular inflation model, which you and I talked about 2 years ago, Eric, and we were making the call that some of the elements of inflation were in fact not transitory, and we were likely to see significant change to policy that back then. Our secular inflation model is still saying that the underlying trend of core PCE inflation has migrated about 100 to 150-ish basis points higher relative to the prior decade. So We still believe that the inflation genie has not been put back in the bottle. It probably won't be truly put back in the bottle until we get to the other side of a recession. But as we started the conversation with and continue to have a decent amount of confidence in, the other side of recession could be a long ways away. And between the other side of recession, between now and the other side of recession, could just be more evidence of a rising probability of a soft landing. And we need investors to understand that. Even if you're, you know, if you're bearish, you have to understand that it will pay to wait till you start to receive some confirmation, either from asset markets or from the data. We're tracking both daily, six times a week here at 42 Macro. You need to get some confirmation that it's okay to be a bear, because right now we continue to think that the probability of bears getting squeezed into the spring remain quite high.
A lot of people think that the rate cycle is behind us and that peak rates, peak interest rates have already happened. Is that true? Are peak rates behind us? And if not, where could they peak?
Yeah, so we think rates are, we have peaked for this particular business cycle. It's unlikely that we move back into a realm where nominal GDP is in the sixes or even higher than that. So in our opinion, you know, at around 4%, 4.5%, the 10-year treasury is appropriately priced, especially if you look at this from the perspective of term premia on slide 65. You know, we had term premia are, you know, basically flat after being, you know, deeply negative for much of the past decade plus. We had a nice pop into positive territory a few months ago when we were having the bond market and really global asset sell-off in the summertime swoon, you know, that unwound itself. So you can make the case that, you know, bonds are fairly appropriately priced or fairly priced as they've been in quite some time. And so in our opinion, we probably have seen peak rates for the cycle. But that does not necessarily mean that they're about to head down in a material fashion over the medium term, because, again, we don't see that as the highest probability outcome either, because we're not calling for a hard landing, at least not yet.
A lot of people are calling for as many as twice as many interest rate cuts from the Fed as the dot plot is officially representing. What's your take? How many interest rate cuts do we get in 2024? Where do we end in terms of policy rates at the end of the year?
Oh, yeah, great question. So, I mean, I don't play pin the tail on the donkey on policy rates. I think there's a lot more higher hanging fruit to pick off the tree from the perspective of managing risk. But on slide 34, we just show what's priced into money markets from the perspective of the policy rates. So for the Fed in the top panel, ECB, second panel, UKIP, Bank of England, third panel, Bank of Japan, fourth panel. You know, over the next 12 months, we're pricing in about seven rate cuts in terms of OIS curves out 1 year. So that's obviously quite aggressive relative to the Fed's guidance of three rate cuts. We think there's a reconciliation process headed for us in the over the medium term, and that reconciliation process won't be good from the perspective of risk assets, and it is a big threat to the current Goldilocks regime. But in our opinion, that reconciliation process is not going to come out of nowhere. It's going to have to come from evidence of a no landing rising at the expense of the current soft landing being the modal outcome. In our opinion, we have not seen any real hard evidence that a no landing scenario is the highest probability outcome. You know, so in our opinion, yes, this what the markets are pricing in from a rate cut cycle perspective is aggressive. We think that there is a day of reckoning ahead of us. But again, putting on that trade today, you know, requires some very aggressive assumptions with respect to where productivity is going to be, where unit labor costs are going to be, where employment costs are going to be, and ultimately where nominal GDP is going to be. And I don't think we as investors have received enough information, new information from the economy, to suggest that those positive trends and all those sort of core underlying features of the economy have changed. And so once we get evidence that those something has potentially changed, and again, we're going to get a lot of data this week, once we get evidence that something has potentially changed, and our quantitative risk management signals, namely that global macro risk matrix that we talked about on slide 6 and slide 7, if those things start to change, then we'll start to say, hey, it's time to, you know, really think about booking some gains in this bull run that we've really, our clients at 42 Macro have benefited from over the past year.
Darius, let's talk fiscal policy. We got about 10 months until the election. It's going to be an interesting ride, I think. What should we expect in terms of fiscal policy, and how's it going to affect the market?
Yeah, more good news. Less good. I mean, it's less good than it had been. You know, the fiscal impulse is definitely getting smaller, but it's still positive at the margin. So if we go to slide 33 up, that's our fiscal policy monitor that helps us keep track of different changes in the composition and size of different elements of the federal revenues and expenditures. So what we show is that, you know, if you look at the year-over-year nominal delta of the federal budget deficit in 2023, it was up $364 billion. the massive fiscal stimulus, and that was is actually smaller than it was in June, would have peaked out at about plus $834 billion year over year in June. That number since trended lower, but it's still obviously a massive number. And so some of the elements that drove that number higher throughout 2023 are unlikely to be repeated, certainly not to the same degree that we are here in 2024. And you think about things like individual income taxes, which are about half the federal budget deficit, that, they were down 16% year over year at last year, thanks to, California and parts of Hawaii being offline from a tax collection perspective. You had a cost of living increase adjustment of plus 8.7% that inflated things like Medicare and Social Security, which are 14 and 22% of the federal expenditures, respectively. Those things are growing plus 17%, plus 12% last year. They're not going to grow as fast as they were this year as they did last year. Yet net interest, which obviously the government is paying interest to the private sector, folks who own those bonds. And by the way, the private sector now is the dominant shareholder of marketable treasury securities at north of 50% now, up from about 36% in late 2021. We were growing net interest at about 41% year over year, back-to-back years. And obviously net interest is being about 12% of the budget deficit is obviously one of these big factors that has contributed to, some of the resiliency in household incomes. We got the first part of the QRA today, this morning or this afternoon. If we look at slide 52, we haven't gotten the updated issuance composition yet. That's going to come at 8:30 on Wednesday this week. But we did get some insights in terms of how the Treasury is thinking about its immediate term borrowing path. And it continues to be very positive. And it's something that's very much in line with what our research has been signaling since late October in terms of the Treasury really supporting asset markets with its policy mix. So if you look at the Q1 2024 net marketing borrowing estimate of $760 billion, that's down $19 billion from the estimate in the October 2023 QRA. If you look at the marketable borrowing estimate for the second quarter of this year, that's all the way down at $202 billion. That's $558 billion delta on a quarter over quarter basis. So if you if you're bearish on, liquidity dynamics in the economy, it's definitely not going to come from the Treasury, at least not over the very immediate term. If you look at slide 51, we show the elements of our net liquidity model, that balance sheet minus TGA minus RRP, the model that Morgan Stanley made very popular across the globe of Wall Street. That's neither here nor there. Now, the elements of that model, we're talking about the TGA getting down to $750 billion and sticking there by the end of Q1. Sticking there for Q2. So there's obviously some dry powder from the perspective of both the RRP in terms of the Janet Yellen and her friends continuing to tap that as a source of excess demand for T-bills relative to coupons. And there's obviously about 70-ish billion dollars or $80 billion thereabouts of excess TGA that needs to be spent down into the end of Q1 or Q2. And oh, by the way, they're likely to announce something on the order of the Treasury buyback. We're going to get information about that this year and when they're going to start that program, as well as they're talking. Lori Logan, Dallas Fed President Lori Logan, floated the idea of tapering the Fed's so-called quantitative tightening program. Now, the Fed isn't doing quantitative tightening. You and I both know that. They're doing balance sheet roll-off because they're not selling bonds into the market, but that's neither here nor there. What really matters is to asset markets is are these dynamics getting better or worse at the margins? And at the margins, they continue to get better from the perspective of U.S. And global liquidity. And final slide, final thing I'll say on global liquidity. The impulse is appreciably positive for the second consecutive month. We show that on slide 48, our global liquidity proxy, which is the global central bank balance sheet, global broad money supply, and global FX reserves minus gold. That number is appreciably positive over the next couple of months. And if you look at slide 49, complicated chart, we don't have time to explain here now, but the key takeaway is that we should expect the elements of global liquidity that are being driven by private sector, private market participants, those elements are likely to continue trending high over the medium term, absent some material change in this discussion around macro disinflation, absent a material change in the discussion around a rising probability of a soft landing in the U.S., and absent any material change in some of the green shoots that we're observing globally from the perspective of global economies, which we can touch on now.
Darius, let's move on to China. But before we even get into the Chinese data, I want to start at a really high level, which is tell me how I should be thinking about China. Beck, earlier in my life, the best way for an American to think about China was as a vendor. That was the role of China in the global economy, was to build stuff and sell it to us through Walmart. What should we be thinking? Is China a competitor? Is China a rival? Is China still a vendor? Who is China to the West? And how should we be thinking about them and their role in the marketplace?
So China's increasingly a rival to the West. It's broadly uninvestable from the perspective of long-term capital allocators. We kind of, you know, reiterate that view. We authored that view going back to February of last year when we were telling investors to sell China and liquidate their China and related holdings. And that was obviously a great call. And then calling for, you know, U.S. exceptionalism is exactly what we have seen and continue to see globally. So, but with respect to China from a cyclical standpoint, we do believe that China is viable for a trade. Now, I don't ever feel comfortable telling anyone with their own money or their client's money to go buy a share of a Chinese company because you're not really buying what you think you're buying. But I do believe that, you know, China proxies, particularly in the commodity space, certainly have upside risk over the medium term. So we'll kind of just walk you through our thesis on that. So on slide 131, where we show total loans of financial institutions in China and the year-over-year growth rate of fiscal expenditures in China, we just use these as proxy for Chinese catch-all proxies for Chinese policy. Most credit allocation in China is administrative in terms of the targets that the PBOC sets for various sectors of the economy. And then obviously the fiscal expenditures coming directly from the government itself. What we see is that credit growth and the fiscal expenditures growth tends to peak in Q1 on a calendar basis in China. So that typically means that Beijing typically front loads policy support. And so that's exactly what we're seeing. If you look at slide 32, this is the third consecutive month. The China liquidity impulse has been appreciably positive. Hasn't really done anything for the Chinese economy, but it's certainly supporting global asset markets vis-a-vis global liquidity. And again, just for those of investors who are unfamiliar with our work on liquidity, China liquidity proxy is just the PBOC's balance sheet plus broad money supply in China plus China's FX reserves minus gold. If you look at slide 133, the PBOC continues to flex its balance sheet to push both broad and targeted stimulus into the real economy. So we're just showing all the various tools and levers that the PBOC uses to enact Chinese monetary policy vis-a-vis repo rates, medium-term facility rates, the loan prime rates, the reserve requirement ratio, which they cut last week, effective next week, about $139 billion of incremental fresh liquidity being pumped into the Chinese economy, Chinese financial sector. And then on the bottom panel, we show our China liquidity proxy, PBOC balance sheet, PBOC FX reserves on the PBOC's balance sheet. So the key takeaway here is that a lot of those black lines in these charts, whether it be, you know, all the lending facilities that the Chinese, the PBOC has implemented at about $2.6 trillion, numbers going straight up. If you look at the supplemental lending, it's right around $500 billion thus far, that number's going straight up. You look at reserve requirement, so that number's going to come down in terms of the cut to the reserve requirement ratio. And you just, in aggregate, the Chinese PBOC's balance sheet continues to grow. It's at about $6.4 trillion. So, you know, the PBOC continues to push liquidity into the Chinese economy. If you look at slide 134, you know, a lot of investors are concerned that it might have an inflationary impact. And I would suspect that, you know, just more headlines around this information and also the fact that, you know, a lot of this liquidity is likely to wind itself up across borders from a fungibility perspective. You know, you're going to see, it's very likely we see, you know, medium-term appreciation in commodity markets, but probably not the kind of, you know, big boom blockbuster appreciation that will get investors very nervous about inflation. And the reason I say that is because we're likely to see offsetting renminbi depreciation as a function of that. This chart here on slide 134 shows the PBOC's balance sheet, foreign exchange reserves. The red line shows the PBOC's balance sheet total assets. And you can see the foreign exchange reserves are at about 48% of the PBOC's balance sheet, down from about a peak of 83% in March of 2014. You know, once the renminbi really started to break out on a real effective exchange rate basis, you really started to see capital outflows and persistent capital outflows in the Chinese economy, because ultimately what's happening here, you know, China Inc. is not generating enough of those current account flows to inflate the money supply in China like it used to. So a lot of the money supply inflation that we've seen in China since 2014 over the past decade or so has really just come by the PBOC flexing its muscles, and flexing its muscles is obviously disinflationary. And so if we continue to see depreciation, that's obviously a disinflationary force for the global economy and positive for risk. So if you look at this from a cyclical standpoint, Eric, Chinese growth has stabilized, what we show on slide 135, just showing the composite PMIs for the US, Eurozone, UK, Japan, China, and the global economy. It's green shoots globally. There's no economy, no major economy that's slowing at the current juncture, and most of them are starting to trend higher. Now, we're not calling for a material big surge in global growth that, you know, investors need to get all horned up about, but certainly things stabilizing globally relative to some extremely muted expectations over the medium term could create an upside trade, you know, for, again, global commodity prices and, you know, pro-risk emerging market type exposures. You know, we're never going to be, hey, you got to be overweight emerging markets. You know, that's not, that's, I think that call's dead in the context of some of the AI development we're seeing here develop domestically. But I do believe those things could have some positive absolute returns. Slide 136, the evolution of consensus estimates for Chinese growth. Those numbers are quite low relative to the official target. So you could see some upside momentum develop in those numbers over the coming months. Again, you know, we're not calling for a big raging boom bull market in China. We're not even calling for Chinese growth to really materially inflect higher. We're just saying that they're going to front load policy support, and investors need to be aware that they're front loading policy support. So they expect liquidity to trend higher globally as a function of Chinese liquidity, and expect more positive headlines, at least over the medium term. Now, broadening this out, Eric, I mentioned that China was extremely uninvestable from the perspective of a long-term capital allocator, and there's a few reasons why. Slide 137, we just show China's poor demographics, just showing the five-year forward old age dependency ratio relative to the working age population ratio, that five-year forward CAGR. You know, China's just in no man's land from the perspective of its demographics relative to other emerging market economies. China is among the worst credit cycle dynamics of any major economy. On slide 138, where we show the five-year Z-score, the non-financial sector credit to GDP ratio, and the non-financial sector debt service ratio, both those numbers are way too high to expect, you know, a significant rebound in the Chinese economy or sustained rebound in the Chinese economy. You know, if you look at slide 139, where we unpack the debt, the credit to GDP ratio on a time series basis, you know, China's got a world beating private sector debt burden, and that's going to be a problem for Chinese economic growth for a long time in the context of slide 140, where we show China's debt service ratio. China's debt service ratio at about 21% means one out of every $5 renminbi of gross domestic income growth is going to service debt. So this is what we mean by the liquidity trap that we called for in China. China is pushing on a string from a policy perspective, and we can see hard evidence of that on slide 141. If you look at the China credit impulse, that's the black line in this chart here. You know, you go back and look at the previous cycles, you know, China credit impulse typically rises very sharply in response to countercyclical monetary and fiscal policy in China. But we have not seen that in this particular cycle. And in our opinion, the reason we have not seen that is because of this liquidity trap dynamic that we called for back in February 2023. And is obviously was the right call in terms of getting investors out of long China into potentially short China and short related assets. So, you know, I think it's a complicated question, Eric. You know, certainly I do believe that China could create a tailwind for asset markets over the medium term. But from the perspective of Chinese assets, I mean, it's going to take a lot more structural reforms, which we believe that are unlikely to be implemented over the near term to get investors truly excited about that particular risk.
Darius, you just did a deep dive on China's balance sheet dynamics. Do you have the same data for the U.S.? Can we do the same deep dive on U.S. balance sheet dynamics?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been featured in these presentations every month for 42 Macro clients since going back to the summer of 2022, when we authored the resilient U.S. economy theme that got bears ran over or steamrolled rather in 2023. And by the way, we're bullish bearish. You know, we go both ways here at 42 Macro. So when I poke fun at bears, just take it in good spirits. At some point, I'll be poking fun at bulls. So it is what it is. But just getting back to this balance sheet question here. If we show slide 17. In that deck where we show household balance sheets being flushed with cash. So what we're showing here in this chart top panel is the total amount of cash on household balance sheets, and that comprised of checkable deposits and currencies and money market fund exposure. And at 5% of total household assets, households have not had this kind of share of cash or this kind of stock of savings of cash since the 1950s. So that's obviously quite positive. When you look at U.S. balance sheet dynamics further on slide 18, third panel and fourth panel there, draw your eyes to those panels. Household debt to nominal GDP is at a 73.7% in most recent print, obviously well lower than what it was in prior business cycles. So definitely some room for the household sector here in the U.S. to lever up if they wanted to spend more and extend the business cycle. Household debt service ratio is an effective all-time low of 9.8%. So obviously very, very favorable dynamics from the perspective of the U.S. household sector. So quite the opposite of what we're seeing in China. If you look at this from the perspective of corporates, slide 19, where we show corporate balance sheets, those are flush with cash as well. That 5%, same similar ratio in terms of total cash divided by total corporate assets. That's about 5%, highest ratio we've seen since going back to the mid 1950s. If you look at corporate floating rate debt, for instance, divided by their total debt, only at 33% of the total, much higher. You've seen significantly higher ratios going back previous business cycles. And then lastly, on slide 20, where we show corporate debt the nominal GDP, that ratio in the third panel, and the corporate debt service ratio in the fourth panel, you know, at 76.5% and 41.5% respectively. You know, we're not at levels that would get you really concerned about the sustainability of the U.S. business cycle and really the long-term outlook for, you know, generating profits and generating economic output, generating productivity here in the U.S. economy, which is why, in our opinion, you know, the U.S. exceptionalism story is not dead. Everyone wants to get you to go buy small caps, and everyone wants to get you to go buy your favorite cousin's emerging market economy because everyone's trying to play catch up from, you know, not listening to 42 macro in 2023. But the reality is a lot of the things that have created the U.S. outperformance are very much stable and likely to persist from a balance sheet perspective. And so that's why we started all of our presentations since the summer of 2022 with these balance sheet dynamics to help investors understand the resiliency of the economy. So I think if investors aren't doing this kind of deep dive analysis on the economy on a, you know, 6 days a week, I highly recommend they partner with somebody that is, because again, you know, understanding this information is the difference between getting steamrolled for a year and actually making a ton of money. And obviously our job is to help our clients at 42 Macro make a ton of money.
Well, Darius, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Before I let you go, tell us a little bit more for people who do want to gain access to this incredible slide deck that you have. It's not just a one-time thing for 42 Macro subscribers. They can get updated versions of this every single month. And you also do regular newsletters and other publications along with us. Tell us about the suite of offerings that are available at 42 Macro.
Well, Eric, I appreciate that, man. It's always a pleasure. Thank you for having me. You know, I hate wearing the sales guy hat, but obviously I got a family to feed and employees to pay. So, I'll just say, you know, look, like I said, we do research like this on a regular basis at 42 Macro. This particular slide deck is our January 2024 monthly macro scouting report. We publish that at the beginning of every month. We also, at the end of every week on Saturday, we publish a weekly webcast called the Around the Horn. That's a much more condensed short version of this with respect to and really focused on what investors should be doing from a risk management standpoint in asset markets. And then daily, we write about each of these dynamics in our leadoff morning note. That's chock full of slides as well. So, you know, you think about our leadoff morning note as like a daily version of connecting the dots between each monthly macro scouting report. And every weekend, we update investors with respect to Around the Horn. So come check us out, 42 Macro. Highly recommend it. One of the best investments you'll make from the perspective of managing risk and also from the perspective of learning more about how these critical economic dynamics work. Because if you don't do macro, macro will do you. I think investors have learned that lesson the hard way the last few years.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Gelarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Darius back on the show. Now, joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Gelarnik. Now, let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Darius's picture saying looking for the downloads. Now, Eric, let's cover crude oil, starting with the EIA inventory.
Crude oil built 1.2 million barrels, Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 2 million barrels, gasoline building 1.2 million barrels, distillates drawing down 2.5 million barrels. That's a net petroleum drawdown of 100,000 barrels. U.S. production bouncing back to 13 million barrels. Remember, it was at 13.3. Then we had a massive 1 million barrel drawdown last week because of inclement weather in North Dakota, making it too cold to pump oil in the Bakken. They're getting a lot of that idled production back online this week, and that's why we're seeing the bounce. The question, as I mentioned last week, is how long it will take us to get all the way back up to 13.3 million barrels. We saw a nice bounce this week, getting most of the way there. Hopefully the rest comes in the next few weeks. Overall, the market continues to firm up. We've sustained above the 55-day moving average for over a week now, so that's definitely a bullish sign. I wouldn't go so far as to say that we have a face-ripping rally or anything, but it does look like a trend higher is finally in place. Time spreads are confirming that, and I personally think it's a much bigger question mark than most market participants seem to have considered, as to just how far this situation with the Houthis and the Red Sea could go.
I've been for several weeks, Eric, looking for a breakout above that December high to really show that there's a new accumulation cycle happening. It didn't make lower lows. It created a base, starting a pattern of breaking out. To me, this entire area around the 50-day moving average, which lies in that $74, $75 area, is going to be a real inflection point. If we see this dip get bought and the support lines hold in that area, and turn back up, I see every opportunity for crude oil to get into the mid-80s. And now I know we had Anas on the show saying that we could stay in these lower boundaries for the entire year. And while I see that as a big picture view, I still don't see anything out of character if crude oil went up even temporarily up into the 90s before mean reverting back down to the bottom end of the ranges. So we'll be looking to see whether this wave of the cycle has a more upside on crude oil. Okay, moving on to equities. I want to get Nick involved in this conversation. Now, Nick, the S&P 500 had a huge rip all week, and then the FOMC turned it. What levels are you watching, and what do you make of this market?
Yeah, Patrick. So right now, the spot price of SPX is approximately 48.65. We have a call wall above at 49.50 and a put wall below at 4,800, which is also heavy support. The implied move for the February 16th monthly OPEX is plus minus 100 points. Therefore, the upper implied move is 49.65 and the lower implied move is 47.65. Key resistance is above right now at 4,900. All that said, I'm inclined to think that we see a move lower somewhere around the 46.50 mark on SPX. However, with Meta, Apple, and Amazon reporting tonight, it's still to be determined if we're going to see that move lower or not. Also, Powell spoke yesterday at the FOMC meeting. He was not nearly as dovish as he was in the prior meeting and has kind of pushed out the possibility of rate cuts. So the market kind of got spooked by that. I'm waiting to see pretty much if we break that key level of 4,800, which is also support. And I'm kind of in this holding pattern right now.
I agree with almost everything you said. The key here for me is 4,800. One day does not make a new trend. This certainly was a breakdown candle, but it was a breakdown on the FOMC, really from a very overbought state. The market really would have needed a very dovish statement in order to just keep plugging away. So we have some sort of a correction underway, but like you were referencing, that one day correction could immediately reverse if we have bullish gaps on earnings on those Mag 7 stocks that are reporting. To me, the 4,800 level you referenced is the pivot. If we have any correction, even if it drops another 50 points, it's nicely bought on dip and turns back up, we could be punching 5,000. To me, when we break below 4,800, that signifies that there's one, that there's a short-term top put in, but then there's some sort of bigger, more prolonged correction, usually the ones that last a month or more and usually are of the 5%+ variety, might get underway. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the big kahuna is here and that there's some big recessionary bear market drop about to happen. Often we need to see topping formations, and we could spend months just sorting out things along these highs. The primary trend is still bullish, and Darius Dale was referencing that you know, this momentum still continue, but the rally getting checked here and us going through some sort of a correction, maybe as deep as that 4,600 level you were referencing, is 100% on the table. Moving on, Nick, I wanted to get your levels on the NASDAQ.
So right now, the Qs have a spot price of approximately 420. There's a call wall above at 430, also all-time highs, and a put wall right where we are right now at 420. The implied move for the February 16th monthly OPEX is plus minus 12 points. Therefore, the upper implied move is 432, which would be new all-time highs, and the lower implied move is 408. Right now, key resistance is above at 430 all-time highs, and key support is below at 410, which are previous all-time highs. Again, I'm inclined to think that we see a pullback in broad markets, but again, that's contingent upon Meta, Apple, and Amazon reporting tonight. We'll see how they do and go from there.
the big thing for me is whether or not we finally see some sort of sector rotation. If those MAG 7s in any way disappoint and start moving down, it doesn't need to drive a liquidity event, but it may finally end the cycle where the MAG 7 were the true generals and leadership. And maybe we might see some of the beaten down sectors, particularly yield sensitive areas, start getting some of that rotation. And I think before I jump to the conclusion that that's underway, I think we just need to see what happens on these earnings. But if we really do see those MAG 7s turn, that's definitely a thesis that I want to kind of see whether it starts to develop. Anyway, moving on to the volatility index, Nick, the VIX remains actually quite low. I mean, it was not exactly a crazy day yesterday. I mean, it was a correction, but it certainly didn't drive these spikes up into the high teens on the volatility index that one would have thought would start to accompany it when market participants are getting nervous. We're still in a very low vol range. And to me, I can't help but to think that being a long vol here going into February is a reasonable way to be positioned. Particularly, I was going to highlight, while I don't have the chart here on the longer term, we still have like 3 month and 6 month volatility premiums still in the mid to high teens. And 1 year volatility that is overlapping the elections is still in the teens as well. And so overall, the entire vol structure is very low. And I just think that the market has so much room to be more volatile than the current conditions are suggesting. What's your take on the VIX here then?
Yeah, so with the VIX right now at around a level of 14, that denotes approximately 0.8% movements top to bottom intraday on SPX. Volatility has been very subdued, primarily because of these buy right and covered call selling ETFs, which are selling premium in both directions as we move around. So right now, with that key level at 4,800 on SPX, that's the key gamma flip area. If we get below that somehow today or tomorrow, perhaps, we could see a wave of selling that surprises a lot of market participants and pushes us to the downside in a very rapid fashion. I don't really expect that to happen. But again, these are the kind of events that happen out of left field that no one really expects and no one's really prepared for. I do agree that 3 and 6 month volatility is very, very cheap. And the market's essentially pricing out any exogenous risk events that will likely transpire at some point in time. Again, what those will be remains to be seen. But moving on to page 7, we have the US dollar index. What are your thoughts here?
Well, we're consolidating and hovering just over 103. It's very curious to my mind as to what's driving this tape action. The reaction to Jay Powell saying effectively that a March rate cut was not something that anyone should expect or not to plan on it, really, that was a fairly muted reaction in the dollar compared to what I was expecting from a statement of that magnitude. So I don't know what's holding us up at 103 spot something, why we haven't come down from this level, what's holding us above 103, and why it didn't move higher above that level on Jay Powell's comments today. So I'm a little bit baffled by this tape action in the dollar.
Eric, this level on the dollar index continues to be incredibly important to me. Not only have we fully retraced that December Powell pivot, but we are consolidating in this range. We obviously have an ECB that has now also given dovish indications. And I think that in order for the dollar to be weak and head back down to the 100 level, I think it's a competition between which central bank is going to be more dovish over the next coming period. If we see any of the data cracking in the economic numbers being released in the weeks and months to come, that could arguably spur a dollar reaction. To me, a breakout above this 104 to 104.5 while sustaining above the 50-day moving average would actually feed the risk-off cycle and drive some further corrections. So we're at a pretty critical pivot, and we'll see whether this 104 acts as resistance as we move forward.
Now, on page 8, Eric, you've created this long-term chart on gold. I'm very interested to hear your thoughts on this.
I've rolled my chart over to the April delivery contract on my continuous futures chart, and the contract roll alone accounted for a $20 bump higher in price this week. But the market was firming up even before the effects of the contract roll. And while the knee-jerk reaction lower to Powell on Wednesday, when he made his statements about telling the market not to expect a March rate cut, the move lower in gold was, needless to say, predictable, but frankly, it was muted compared to what I would expect given the magnitude of that statement, and it started retracing within minutes after it happened. It had retraced 50% of the distance that it moved before the close on Wednesday. So it seems like the market is not going to freak out as much as I would have thought about no rate cut from the Fed in March. We'll see how this happens, if the rate cut really doesn't happen, how gold does at that point. Moving out to the longer-term perspective on gold, I've included a weekly gold chart in this week's slide deck to give our listeners a better sense of the big-picture move that we've all been waiting for in this gold market. So the green line shows the level of the 2011 top at $1,922, that blow-off top that we had back in 2011. That's where the cup formation in this cup-and-handle pattern begins in the summer of 2011. The handle portion began with the COVID top starting in the spring of 2020, and that's when the key resistance level of 2089er was established. The upper horizontal magenta line is key resistance at 2089, while the lower magenta horizontal is the weekly closing high until very recently. So the market has moved above that level, above 2028, which was the closing high until very recently, and it sustained above that for the last few weeks now. So it looks like we're getting even closer to a breakout above that key resistance at 2028. If we look at the overall target for this cup and handle formation, I get 2724. That's $2,724 is the upside target, which is measured basically as the size of the cup vertically added to the top magenta line. And you multiply that by 61%, which is the efficiency ratio of this particular measurement, and you end up getting 2724 as an upside target for gold. The signal that would indicate that that is on the table would be a sustained move if we got above the level of 2089 and stayed there for at least a week or two on the continuous futures chart. So we're getting closer and closer to it. If we get that, don't be surprised if you see a lot of volatility in the gold market, because it would be a buy signal to suggest an upside target of 2724.
Now, Eric, I continue to be big picture bullish gold. And so your chart, I totally get your levels and what you're looking at. My biggest question mark is whether or not gold is ready to go here in the first quarter of the year. Once we're in an easing cycle on the back end of the year going into 2025, it's very easy to build the gold thesis. But really trying to figure out when is the actual starting point of a legitimate breakout that gets us beating all of the highs we put in over the last several months is really the key thing to try to sort out. To me, I still think that the first quarter can be a lot more volatile and a lot more likely to have fake outs. And so I'm not trusting any initial breakout. On page 9, you can see we're still trading above the 50-day moving average. And it does still generally look bullish, but I'm a little bit more short-term neutral and think that we could have a fake out and even a temporary trip below 2000 that would only end up being a buy on dip opportunity. In the end, I wanted to just touch on two more charts here. Now, Eric, what are your thoughts here on uranium?
I continued to buy the dips on uranium mining shares this week, and I think the bull market in uranium has only just begun. Of course, nothing ever goes in a straight line, and we've already had a great run here, but I am still max bullish on this market.
Yeah, to me, this has been a buy on dip. because when a market has this kind of momentum, rarely does a V-top. The big question for me is this next leg higher able to beat the previous highs and maintain this kind of momentum? Because if we see divergent momentum and a failure to break to higher highs, that to me would suggest that some sort of a swing high may be coming in and some multi-month correction may start. For now, I'm buying the dip in anticipation that the bulls will prevail, but it'll be really important for them to prove what is next. The last thing I want to touch on is this chart on the 10-year treasury note on page 11. And in the post-FOMC and Powell's press conference, bonds broke out as yields broke down. And it really does look like this is going to a bullish continuation pattern. Staying above its 50-day was a classic flagging formation zigzag pattern. And you have a scenario where if this breaks out, we might be heading back to the levels where we traded in the second quarter of last year, which is levels up around the 116 level on the note. So it'll be interesting to see whether this breakout sticks, but I certainly think that on the short term, bullish bonds looks like it's working.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the slides that Darius Dale provided in the chart book we just discussed here in the post game, including a number of links to articles that we found interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.